tonight.
Thank you.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Monday, February 20th, 2017. We're going to go out of order today. We're going to do House Bill 2113 first, House Bill 2251 second, and then 2248 third. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2113 and call Representative Greenick, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, House Bill 2113 was brought to us by Representative Greenlick. It adds secular organizations to the list of entities authorized to solemnize marriages. It also defines secular organization. There are no amendments, and there is no fiscal or revenue impact.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I'm here to talk to you about a rather simple, straightforward bill. Right now, when a couple wants to get married, they go down and get a marriage license, and they take that marriage license off. They find somebody to marry them, and then after they're married, they have to find somebody to solemnize their marriage, essentially to certify that they've been married. That's done in a secular world by judges or county clerks, and in a sacred world by church officials of various kinds. This bill simply adds another secular alternative to who can solemnize a marriage, and that's an official of secular organizations that for many people serve an equivalent function as being a member of a church congregation. It's a sense of sort of fairness to let people who prefer to be involved in these secular kind of organizations have the same opportunity for those officials to solemnize their marriage. This bill has taken a circuitous route to get here. It passed out of the Rules Committee in the last session, passed the House, went to the Senate, and the Senate got an amendment that added members of the legislature to solemnize marriage. Came back to the House. There were several members of the House that objected to adding members, mostly in the minority caucus, even though that proposal came out of the minority caucus. We didn't have time to get a conference committee to work things out. I'm asking you to follow that along now. Pass this bill to the House floor. We get it out of the House and back to the Senate and see if we can work out any compromises.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Representative Greenlick? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, sir.
Brian Harvey and Kimberly McCullough. It's Harvey.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Kimberly McCullough. I represent the ACLU of Oregon, and as Representative Greenlick said, this is a fairly simple bill. It doesn't contain the things that became controversial in the last session. It was amended to add legislators. That became a controversial issue. The other issue was that it was amended to make it so you didn't have to have the address of the officiants of the organization or religion that was authorizing the officiant. It said you didn't have to have that address because some folks were running into problems if they got authorized by a church and the church no longer exists. Those are not in this bill. Our hope is that they will not be put in this bill and that it just stays simple and sweet so that it can just go through with the things that were not controversial to anyone. I'd just like to point out as well that not only is this a good idea, so that it helps people who belong to these secular organizations that really play a parallel place in their life as a church does to a religious person, to give them the same rights as someone that belongs to a church. But it also is something that will bring our statute in line with both the First Amendment and the Oregon Constitution. There has been litigation in other places around laws just like ours, where they granted these rights to religions and then didn't grant the rights to secular organizations. Those that litigation was successful, and I believe Brian just let me know that there's more litigation, actually more successful litigation, that came out of, I believe, Illinois. So the First Amendment demands this equal treatment, but also the Oregon Constitution. It's actually, interestingly, for those of you who don't know, the Oregon Constitution actually provides more protection than the federal Constitution, particularly in the area of freedom of religion. We actually have five separate provisions in our Constitution that relate to religion, and three of them, actually, Article 1, Sections 2, 3, and 20, all would apply to this particular issue. The founders of Oregon were particularly concerned about the rights of non-believers and believers and unconventional religions. So this is something that they actually made a great point to discuss when they were enacting the Oregon Constitution, and they used language like the rights of conscience in our religious clauses of the Constitution, specifically to call that out. So like I said, I think this should be fairly simple. We just don't want it to get bogged down with other amendments, and hopefully it can just go through and be done, and then it'll be over. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think that Representative Greenlicking, Kimberly, what? My name is Brian Harvey. I apologize. I'm with the Secular Coalition for Oregon. I represent about 16 nonprofit organizations across the state that for their members do provide community and a profound sense of belonging, and very much play the same role that a religious organization might. They're humanist in nature, that is, they don't make an appeal to a higher being, but they do serve much the same role. And many of those organizations do have celebrant training programs where they train secular celebrants to provide similar services that a pastor might, whether it's at a funeral or it's at a wedding. As far as weddings go, those individuals, if they're certified by that organization, can certainly officiate at the wedding, but they can't sign the marriage license. So when the couple says, "I do," at the wedding, they really aren't married yet. They have to then take the form to the courthouse, and a clerk has to be the one to actually solemnize the marriage, not the person who officiated their wedding. Doing that does additionally come with an extra $105 solemnization fee. That's above and beyond and separate from the fee for a marriage license. So there's at least some financial burden there. And what Kimberly alluded to is correct, that in Indiana, they had a law about as identical as it could be to Oregon's current law, which eventually reached the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and was struck down. That has now also been struck down in Illinois, which I believe is also part of the Seventh Circuit. So it's really just an extension of that precedent to Illinois as well. And this was just in the last few weeks. It is true that, you know, you can go online and gain certain credentials and become solemnized online, profess a faith that isn't genuine to you. But these people do have a genuine worldview and a genuine sense of community, and they have people who, for them, are the right people to solemnize their marriage. And I would just like a brief quote from the Seventh Circuit's decision on this matter. They said the plaintiffs were unwilling to pretend to be something they are not, or pretend to believe something they do not. Secular humanists are shut out as long as they are sincere in following an ethical system that does not worship any god, adopt any theology, or accept a religious label. And for us, for me personally, I think that much of the definition of religious liberty extends to the right also to not believe certain things. It doesn't mean, it becomes in some ways a religious test for equal treatment under the law, that you have to make a profession of faith if you expect to be treated equally. And so that is what we're trying to rectify. We're trying to extend those same rights that already exist for people in religious congregations to those who are already part of humanist communities that play that same role and, in fact, have programs that train celebrants exactly for these purposes. So,
thank you. Questions for Representative Stark?
Thank you, Chair Barker. I'm curious this for either of you. Out of what is the purpose of solemnizing any sort of legal contract? And out of all the legal contracts that two people might enter into with one another, why choose this one to be the only one that has to be solemnized?
You know, Representative Stark, Chair Barker, that is a good question. Under Oregon law, you have to get a marriage solemnized, but as far as I know, solemnization doesn't apply to any other sort of legal document that folks have to. You know, you may have to get someone to, like, certify something for you or have a notary public on something or have a witness on your will, something like that. But solemnization is something that's very specific to marriage.
I might add, Chair Barker, Representative Stark, that there are very rare instances, perhaps only one, I think it might be Nevada, and I could be mistaken about that, where they allow the couple to self-solemnize their marriage. But across the states, there is a tradition of requiring a third party to solemnize the marriage. There are a number of reasons I've heard brought up, and I don't know the historicity of, you know, or the accuracy of these things, like the potential for abuse or coercement or elder abuse, or this idea of having a third party might protect against some of those certain things. But to be honest, I don't know why it is such a widespread practice, but it is something that is virtually universal in the states.
Just more of a comment. I know that right now in Alabama, there's a hearing coming up in 2 days on a bill that they passed in 2016 to remove that altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm with some of the arguments you guys have made and discussions we had previously, I'm wondering why add to the list if it's not a specific sacred thing to one group, if it's just a generic contract that people enter into, then why have it? Anyway, so it's, and I know they're Alabama right now, Senate Bill 20, you can look it up, is considering it, and they previously passed it out of the Senate and didn't quite make it through the House.
Yeah, Representative Stark, Chair Barker, I think that that's a good point, and I think there's a lot of different ways that different states deal with this. In the state of California, they actually do this thing where you can get deputized for a day. So anyone you want to marry you, to be that third party, can go down to the local courthouse and get a deputized as a court clerk just for the purpose of saying these two people got married in front of me. And I do think that the reason of, you know, them wanting to say somebody did it is, like Brian said, is so that it hopefully provides, just like when you have people witness your will, it hopefully provides some check on forced marriages, things like that. But I do think there's a lot of different ways we could deal with it. And rather than completely unravel Oregon's marriage statutes, we just decided, let's go ahead and just fix this one little thing. A broader conversation about perhaps fixing it more broadly would be warranted, I'm sure. But we just want to make this one tiny fix.
Thank you, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Kimberly, I guess this would be your question since you brought up the Oregon Constitution. And I'm looking at Article 1, Section 2 and 3, and, yeah, you're right. I didn't realize there was so much disgust in what our founding fathers wrote in this. Mm. But Section 2, freedom of worship, reads, all men shall be secure in the natural right, in capital N for natural, to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of their own consciences. Section 3, freedom of religious opinion. No law shall in any case whatever control the free exercise and enjoyment of religious opinions or interfere with the rights of conscience. I'm just trying to kind of figure out how this bill fits into that.
Yeah, if you would like, I can send you some case law. There's, I've studied this pretty extensively, and there's actually a lot of discussion about it. Oregon's constitution was based on Indiana's constitution. We have the exact same religious freedom clauses, and the way that it has been interpreted, in part based on the discussion at the Oregon constitution's founding, and then also the discussions in Indiana. There's a case, Newport Church of Nazarene versus Hensley, that's out of 2002. Where they talk about the fact that it's impermissible for a statute to draw a distinction between churches and non-church religious organizations. I have all sorts of citations and things that I could, cases I can send you about the interpretation of the Oregon Constitution. It's pretty extensive and separate from the First Amendment. But I would be delighted to send you some more of that.
Please.
Yeah.
Representative Miles.
Chair Barker, about 20 years ago, I served for about 6 years as head of my religious congregation. And at the time, I got a little note card that said, "You're hereby authorized to solemnize marriages." And I took that down and I registered with the Washington County court clerk. About 3 years ago, somebody asked me to marry him. And I said, "Well, I'm no longer in that position. I don't think I can." "Oh, no, we checked with the county clerk. You're still on their registry." Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, what is the case with these? How do we know who really is authorized and who isn't by their organization or congregation if the clerks aren't really doing anything to ferret that out?
Yeah, Representative Vile, Chair Barker, the state doesn't actually do anything to investigate. The way that this would come up is if there was some sort of lawsuit or something that was contested in court, then there are all of these rules that need to be followed, and then they'd have to go back and show, you know, this is who is authorized and so on. But we actually do have a provision in Oregon law that says that if you think that the person who solemnized your marriage had authority to, you are married even if they didn't have authority.
Interesting.
Because they don't want people to get married and somebody said, "Oh, I got my authorization," and they actually didn't, and then you're not married because that person's fault. So it is, the whole system is a little odd, honestly, but that's the way it's set up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to clarify then, the court clerk can solemnize, mm-hmm. but not somebody who's an officiant of a particular belief system that may not be religious in nature.
Representative Gorsuch, Chair Barker, that is correct. But the problem with the clerk is you have to pay them.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, if the clerk has that power, it would seem like the officiant should have that power, in my opinion.
Anything further? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This public hearing go to work session, House Bill 2113.
Mr. Chair, I know you want to take a vote right now on this bill and move this forward and everything, but with what Kimberly just shared with me and being able to have the opportunity to review other cases involved in this, I would like to be able to have that opportunity before I make a vote on this.
Okay.
Chair Barker?
Yes.
I likewise have some questions that I thought I knew what I now didn't know, and I would like to have some time to consider this as well.
We'll roll this over for a brief period of time, a few days. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2251.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2251 was brought to us at the request of the Department of Corrections. It prohibits persons under age 18 from being incarcerated in a Department of Corrections institution. We are still waiting on the fiscal impact statement.
Okay. Thank you. Heidi Stewart and Christine Kirk.
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Heidi Stewart. I'm with the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2251. As introduced, House Bill 2251 ensures that any person under the age of 18 cannot be incarcerated in a Department of Corrections facility and codifies current practice. And by codifying current practice, not only do we think it's the right thing to do, but it also ensures continued compliance with the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act. Through recent conversations with the Oregon Youth Authority, our two agencies are working to draft amendments to establish criteria for transfers for those under the age of 18 under very extraordinary and very limiting circumstances. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Christine Kirk, and I work for the Oregon Youth Authority. I just wanted to echo my colleague's statement that this matches existing practice. You'd have to go back past 2008 to see a large number of youth being transferred from the Oregon Youth Authority to the Department of Corrections prior to their 18th birthday. It is not something that we do any longer. And so it makes sense to put this into law. We are currently just having some discussions to make sure, because we're looking at the abnormality, the what if that we may not consider. And so we thought we would just spend some time talking about that to see if there are circumstances at which we would want to have that flexibility. As noted, it is difficult to do, though, because of the existing laws that are in place that limit association between youth and adults. But we just wanted to have some time to talk about that. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Chair and I actually spoke about this morning, and I wanted to bring it up because you're here and because of the number on this and everything. I'm very in favor of this. One of the things that a situation that bothers me because of the work that we've been doing at Hillcrest, I think it's only about 50 a year or so, perhaps, fall into this. An 18-year-old finishes his time at Hillcrest, McCollum, whichever, and the home situation is horrendous. In this case, I'm thinking of a young man right now,
okay,
who's 18, who's getting out in the next couple of days, and he has nothing. I mean nothing. So a friend and I are buying him some shoes, some jeans, some shirts, some things, a backpack, and a bunch of stuff. I know it's not part of this bill, but is there a way we could somehow work maybe something in here? It's maybe 50 kids a year, if that, have nothing when they come out. And if they, like in this case, this kid would go home to where he left at 13.
Mm-hmm.
So he can't wear the clothes that are at his old home.
Mm-hmm.
Have nothing. And so I'm not looking to get money out of the budget. I'm looking, what if we could somehow, I don't know if it'd fit in here, if an organization or a persons are willing to take care of these kids' mm-hmm. needs as soon as they get out. Mm-hmm. I know this is kind of unrelated. I'm sorry, Chair Barker. Just, I needed to get it on record because it was really, it's a heartbreaking situation, and I'm sure you know all about
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Chair Barker, Representative, thank you very much for your question. Without knowing the particulars of this youth and knowing where they're headed on supervision, and I think that actually my colleague can help in addressing on the adult side for someone who might be in the Department of Corrections, who's over 18 upon release. For those that we supervise, we actually do have funds and things available to buy clothes and those sorts of things if needed, because you're absolutely right. Not all youth have access to what we might consider basic necessities that everyone should have upon release, and so that we do consider and look at those. For those youth who are being released and are convicted, the Department of Corrections and our community corrections partners would be looking towards supervision. With that said, however, if there's a youth who is leaving our custody and there are things that they need and do not have, that is certainly something that we can work to address also while they're in our custody. And often we do make different decisions for youth as they're headed towards release. And if there's a question about what they have or don't have, we err on the side of making sure they have some basic necessities. Shoes is an example, I think, comes up pretty commonly. And so that they have what they need to be able to go to their appointments and those sorts of things. Thank you okay. for what you're doing. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. So what happens, somebody's 17 and they're convicted of something that has, say, a 3-year sentence or something like that. They go to OYI, and then what happens when they get to be 19?
So Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, if they get a three-year sentence, they would do their entire sentence with the Oregon Youth Authority. They can stay there until the age of 20, just before their 25th birthday.
Good.
Okay, thank you very much. As we said, it's not ready to move yet. Look at the fiscal. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2251. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2248.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2248 was also brought to us by the Department of Corrections. It would remove the sunset on the current law allowing the Oregon Youth Authority and county juvenile departments to provide materials regarding a youth's history and prognosis to DOC for the purpose of enabling DOC to perform its official duties. And we are currently waiting on an amendment that, instead of removing the sunset, would extend it to January 2020.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, can I ask you a question on the previous bill?
Yes.
Does it cost less per day to be an OYI than a DOC?
It's a lot more expensive than OYI than the prison.
I'm sorry, OYA is more expensive. So that's why there'd be a fiscal for this one.
I don't think so.
It wasn't about the fiscal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking about the fiscal.
It wouldn't make. For those, that would be a very small number, but even if there is a fiscal, you don't want 16-year-olds going to the.
No, I definitely don't. I was just wondering why there was a fiscal on it.
There's not a fiscal. Can I clarify?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenlick, the two agencies are trying to come to together on language that would allow for an extraordinary circumstance by which a youth would have to be housed at DOC. They're trying to think of what those situations might be, mm-hmm. so that it's not a total prohibition and an extraordinary case came up and they couldn't manage that case. So those are the amendments we're waiting for.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, please, on this one.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, again for the record, I'm Heidi Stewart with the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2248. As introduced, House Bill 2248 removes the sunset date on temporary law and makes permanent law authorizing the Department of Corrections access to juvenile records. In light of recent conversations with our partners, we have agreed on amendments to extend the sunset as opposed to removing it. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Christine Kirk and I work for the Oregon Youth Authority. The sharing of information between the juvenile system through the juvenile justice information system to the Department of Corrections has actually only been occurring for about a year. While this passed prior, it took a little bit for us to come to an agreement. We had to develop a MOU between the JJIS Steering Committee, which is made up of the Oregon Youth Authority and county partners, and TRAIN. And so it hasn't been that long that we have had this sharing between entities. I would like to state that this is something that we audit, and in those audits, we are able to determine if the Department of Corrections, which is a very few group of people who need to know this information and use it for work purposes and continuity of case planning and safety, that we are able to look at the people access cases that are under the jurisdiction and what's allowed within this law. Initially, there were just some training issues because there are a couple different systems that people can look in, and immediately, Department of Corrections was a very good partner and has been in immediately working on those training issues and monitoring, and it's been a very good partnership in that sense, but it has only been a year. And so the extension of the sunset makes some sense just to give us all more time, as well as continue any conversations that should occur.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2248. Any further coming before the committee today?
You going to introduce any bills, or is that?
Nothing to introduce today.
Okay. All right. So.
Okay.